Hello there, I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
And I'm the Baron Vaughn that Leonard Maltin is with.
It's, you know, it's amazing, but you are. And you're right there in front of me.
It's one of my better qualities.
It's nice to see you.
Good to see you too, sir.
And we've been doing our homework, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
You know what's interesting is that I remember all these movies that we talk about on our show.
Yeah.
But I find revisiting them a really eye-opening experience. No pun intended.
Hey.
But it is fascinating to go back and refresh your memory. And in some cases, it's been enough years. We're going to talk about films today that don't go back 20 to 30 years, in fact.
Yeah.
As well as a very recent
one. A recent film, yeah.
And seeing them again, you just see them with fresh eyes.
And it's fresh eyes, but also you have more experience. You have more maturity.
You've seen
the trends that have happened in film where – there's like now a context for where some of these films belong that is interesting to think about and entertain when you watch them. But I love revisiting movies, especially if it's something I loved when I was younger. And then I see it again as an adult. I'm like, oh, now I see why I liked this for real. It's always great.
It's true. It's true. And every movie – this is a spiel I do to my students.
Okay.
But every movie, wittingly or otherwise, is a mirror of its time.
Yes, absolutely.
There's just no getting around it. It doesn't mean to be, but it just is. Whether it's about fashion or slang.
Yes.
Or
espionage.
Or genres.
Yes.
Or music. Music's a big component to that.
Exactly.
And you can
– fashion, yeah.
It's absolutely of its moment in time, and there's no escaping it. Now, some movies hold up so well – that becomes just an incidental footnote. Okay, yeah, it's very 80s, it's very 90s, whatever it may be.
Right, right.
Others are marked by it in a certain
steeped.
Way.
Steeped.
Yes.
Deep fried in the era that it was made in. Yeah.
So we'll get it. We won't be vague like this for much longer. We're going to get into the
yes.
heart of today's show, which is inspired by the release of
The Hunger Games.
Mockingjay.
Part one.
Part one.
Part one. Oh.
A story so big, it needed two parts.
It needed two parts. It's going to be four movies.
That's
yes.
right.
Altogether.
Which means we're going to talk about Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence, who is just a Wunderkind, in a sense, to use my German. But yeah, she's a gigantic star. And what we're talking about today are breakthrough performances.
That's right. So I didn't state the theme.
Yeah, but I stated
Man,
it right now.
I didn't state you. Good save.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Good save, partner.
You're welcome.
We are talking about breakthrough performances.
Yes.
Which is inspired by Jennifer Lawrence because talk about one film making a career.
Yes, definitely.
And that one film for her was Winter's Bone.
Winter's Bone, released 2010.
2010. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance that year and went on to tremendous acclaim. If not big box office success. It's
yes.
an indie movie. It was never destined to be a multiplex movie or,
yeah.
or something like that. But gosh, it's so good.
Yes,
and
very
she,
good.
And she's so good in it. But I think the key – we're going to talk about the movie, of course, and her performance. But I think the key is that we didn't know her.
Yes.
We didn't know who this young woman was.
And that's a big thing – with indie films, why I love indie films and why I love foreign language films a lot of the time is because you don't have that baggage with an actor. You can just tune in to the story and see what's going on, what the filmmaking's about, what the writing is about, and what the performance is about. You're not
that's
thinking,
right.
oh, that's Jennifer Lawrence doing yeah. Jennifer Lawrence-y yeah. things.
Now, the truth is I like the Hunger Games movies because of her.
Yes.
I mean, there's some other good qualities in those films. They're not my favorite kind of movie.
But there are a lot of good performances in those movies.
But she – to me, she makes those films worth seeing because she is that good. She is so solid. She is so committed to her characters and so compelling to watch.
Yeah.
And that was true in Winter's Bone.
The Winter's Bone.
So here, if you haven't seen it, and of course a lot of people haven't.
Yeah.
Because as I said,
it was a little movie.
Yes, and a small movie and a tough movie.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to get through.
This is a stark film.
Yeah.
A very stark
brutal,
film.
Brutal.
Set in the Ozarks, in the backwoods, in a—
Already scary.
Yes. Set in a milieu that I would suspect very few of us know firsthand.
What's that?
That backwoods
oh.
Secretive
Ozarkian
subculture there in the Ozarks.
Almost like mafia sort of – almost like a crime family in some sort of way.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And the if you don't know the film, the gist of it is that Jennifer Lawrence plays a girl named Ree. She's 17 years old and she's carrying an awful lot on her shoulders.
The burden is on this woman's back.
She's
the burden is on this back. I don't think that's an expression, but it is now.
She's got a young brother and sister – and a mother who has had a nervous breakdown, apparently.
She's incapacitated. We see her a few times, but she's just still and quiet and doesn't do much.
Right. So here's a 17-year-old girl who already has a lot to deal with. She's got to serve as kind of a mother to her two siblings, two young siblings, which she's willing to do.
Yes.
But along comes the law. To say that her father, who has fled,
law played by Garrett Dillahunt.
Right, her father's missing in action. He's been cooking up drugs.
Yeah,
he was thrown in the hoosegow and put up their house as collateral for his bail, and he hasn't shown.
Yeah,
and if he doesn't make his next court date in a week, they're going to seize the house.
Right.
So,
and here comes Tate Taylor. I think he's the one who tells her this. Mm-hmm. Tate Taylor plays the bondsman.
Right.
You might know him because he directed The Help and Get On Up.
Right.
But here he's an actor.
Anyway, so now she has to somehow try to find her father. They're going to lose the house. They're going to lose their stability. They're going to lose what little they have on this earth.
Yeah.
And as she goes to try to find her father, she encounters tremendous hostility.
Resistance.
Stonewall of the highest order.
It's not even it's what she wants to ask is it seems very simple.
Where's my father?
Where's my father? But the people that she needs to ask have lots of guards before you can even get to those people. There are a lot of people in front of them.
We won't say more than that. If you haven't seen the movie, we will not reveal more of the plot. But that's the premise, not so much the story. But that's really the springboard for what happens. And this girl has to summon such grit and courage and determination to deal with some really scary people.
Scary, tough, and mean.
Yep. Some of them related to her. Some of them her relatives, blood relatives.
Yes.
But that doesn't seem to count because they all have something to hide. And
there's some sort of Ozarkan code that's on top of all of them that they're following.
Right. So you have to believe that this girl can summon the courage and summon that level of not just inner strength, but outer strength too.
Yes.
She's got – and there are scenes – again, not to give away very much. It's not giving away a lot. But she has to get physical in this movie and she has to be able to be believable, whether it's aiming down a rifle sight to shoot a squirrel or
– Skinning said squirrel.
Yeah. Exactly. And you believe her.
And you have to believe that she's tough and that she's not afraid to stand up to some really scary people that Baron Vaughn would not want to meet in a dark alley in the Ozarks.
You're speaking for yourself.
Then. Yes. I'm saying that I would not want to meet them, but she has to be believable as a person that stands up to these people.
And she just is.
She is.
Now, the question is, if we saw her – if she made this movie today.
Yes.
Would she be as good in the performance? I'm sure she would.
Yeah.
Would we have to erase other images of her in our mind? Yes,
definitely. We would. Lots of baggage now.
Yes, now we see her as this, outgoing, funny, spontaneous young woman who's
very grounded,
exactly, and very unpretentious about herself, paparazzi darling, a three-time Academy Award nominee, and won the Academy Award.
Yes.
In fact.
The lead of a gigantic franchise.
Right.
A very photographed woman.
Yes. And very attractive. We'd have to believe her as this stoic, stone-faced, unglamorous character that she plays.
Well, I know. I was looking up some stuff about this, and it's interesting because it's good to remember that everyone comes from somewhere. I was looking up where was she before this movie came out. So, little-known fact, I guess. I didn't even know this. There's a comedian named Bill Engvall. He's part of the White Collar Comedy Tour. He had a sitcom called The Bill Engvall Show. Jennifer Lawrence played his daughter for a number of years. There were three seasons of it. The last episode, I believe, was September of 2009. That was when the last episode aired. Winter's Bone premiered at Sundance in January of 2010.
Yep.
Months after, this girl was on a Southern multicam sitcom. So she must have shot this movie while she was shooting a sitcom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I read about her audition. They did not want her apparently for this part. They said that she was too pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently she flew herself to New York, walked the street, came into the audition with a runny nose and dirty hair, and of course, nailed it. That's why she has an Oscar nomination for playing this role.
Right.
So Jennifer Lawrence came from somewhere, and that's amazing to think about.
Again, actors acquire baggage through work.
Yes.
Through experience. And it's
– especially when you're good.
And this is why it's so canny of filmmakers to cast unknowns or relative unknowns in key roles sometimes, because you can look at them clear-eyed and have no prejudices, no previous connections with them, and just get absorbed in the character they're playing.
A good example, the Coen brothers. They keep
oh, well.
They seem to keep scouring the Juilliard school for new people, but that's fine because it serves their movies. These are people who can actually act, and then there's not that baggage
exactly.
there, and you can just tune into the film.
Right. As they just did with Oscar Isaac and Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yes. Oscar Isaac, Michael Stuhlbarg, who personally was a person I was following for a while because I was in New York.
Yep.
Then I saw him in A Serious Man. I'm like, of course he's in that because he's brilliant.
Exactly. And let's give credit here to the filmmakers too, because Deborah Granik, who directed and co-wrote this film with her writing partner, Anne Rossellini, it is based on a novel, on a novel by Daniel Woodrell, which I'm unfamiliar with, but boy. strong stuff.
Yeah.
Really potent stuff. But Deborah Granik made another film that I like very much that I'm going to plug here called Down to the Bone.
Huh.
Now, why this bone motif turns up in her filmography, I can't say.
Perhaps it'll be the beginning – it's the beginning of the Bone trilogy.
But in 2004, she made a film called Down to the Bone, which was the first time I saw Vera Farmiga.
Oh.
Who, like Jennifer Lawrence, didn't just, you know – get off the bus. She'd been working too.
Yes.
But this film was a leading role in a high-profile indie film in which she plays a wife and mother who is trying to keep a lid on her drug habit. And it's getting a little out of control.
If there's a thing you're going to keep a lid on, it's that.
And she's terrific in the film. She got some notice for it. And in fact, I think our group, the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, gave her our Best Actress award that year.
Very nice.
And of course, she's had a wonderful career since then.
Yes.
In films and on television where she's doing Bates Motel.
Right. She's a formidable actress.
She is a really talented woman. And she too blossomed under the direction of Deborah Granik. So this is a filmmaker I've got my eyes on. I hope that she continues to do interesting indie work.
And I hope she continues to put the word bone in all of her titles. That's my personal hope. But, you know.
Well, she's two for two.
She's two for two. Let's go for three.
Anything could happen. And Jennifer Lawrence, well, the world's open to her.
Yes.
I mean, the world really is her erster, as my late father-in-law would have said.
And, erster, okay.
Yes, yes. It's New Yorkese.
Okay. I've never heard that pronunciation of oyster before.
But she's managed to make really popular mainstream movies like X-Men First Class.
Yes.
You know, and of course, the Hunger Games series.
Giant franchises.
But she's doing exceptional work in films, David O. Russell's films.
American
Silver
Hustle.
Linings Playbook first, which won her Oscar.
She won an Oscar, yes, definitely.
And then got nominated a year later for American Hustle, playing a totally different kind of character, of course. I'm a fan. I really like her. I wish her a long and fruitful career.
I think she'll have it.
I do too. I think we call it a sucker bet.
A sucker bet?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because
she's in.
She's in? You'd be a sucker not to bet on her.
That's right.
All right.
No, you'd be a sucker to take odds against that.
Still don't understand the expression.
That's true. I can't help you. I don't have all the answers.
That's fine.
I don't have all the answers.
But one answer we have.
Okay. We're doing the best we can.
We're doing the best, yes.
That's all we can, folks. Well, next we're going to take a look back even further.
Through the looking glass.
To a stellar career that had an interesting start on the big screen. And who will that be? Well, you'll just have to wait a moment to find out.
Ooh, good teaser.
Listeners, that would be you, help Malton on Movies stay free to download by completing this short anonymous survey. It'll take no more than 5 minutes, we promise. Your answers will help match our show with advertisers that best fit the sensibilities of our podcast. And as listeners like you, do we have sensibilities, Baron?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And sensibilities.
That's why we need the right advertisers. Listeners who complete the survey will be entered in an ongoing monthly raffle to win a $100 Amazon gift card. That's nice. We promise not to share or sell your email address, which is crucial. And we won't send you any email unless you win. Please go to podsurvey.com/Malton, M-A-L-T-I-N. That's podsurvey.com/Malton to take our survey and get a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Thank you.
Welcome back to Malton on Movies. I'm not Leonard Malton, but I am Baron Vaughn.
Yes, you are, and I'm Leonard Malton.
Oh.
And we are talking about breakthrough performances.
Yes.
Now, our next subject is a certain Will Smith.
Yes, gigantic star.
Now, he'd already broken through in several arenas.
Exactly. At the time that this movie is Six Degrees of Separation. That's the movie we're going to talk about. At the time this movie came out and the time he was making it, he was currently on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the gigantic NBC sitcom. If you don't know The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, well, it's a story all about how his life got flipped, turned upside down. I'd like to take a minute just – oh, wait a minute. I started going to the theme song right there. Sorry. Sorry. That was a condition.
Yeah.
That was a condition for a long time.
Here's a guy who had already, you know, shown, you know, just tremendous charisma.
Yes.
First, in his rapping and in his music videos and his persona in general. And then they build a major – primetime situation comedy around him.
Yes. And to be fair, he nails it.
Of course he does.
He nailed it.
Of course he does.
For years, he nailed it on that show.
Well, you know, he has – first off, he has this amazing personality.
Yeah.
This 1,000-watt personality. He's got comic chops.
Yes.
To spare. And he has a tremendous work ethic. I really admire him. And he talks about his upbringing and his grandmother and how she instilled in him, this desire to succeed and this understanding that it doesn't just happen. You have to work at it.
Right.
And he's taken that to heart ever since.
Ever since. And while he was on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and everyone in America was laughing, some people thought, hey, can this dude do drama? Can he act? Can he actually act?
Somebody decided to make a movie out of the award-winning John Guare play, Six Degrees of Separation.
Yes.
Which had debuted in New York in 1990 and which I was lucky enough to see.
Oh, you saw the original cast of it.
Yes, I did.
With James McDaniel?
Well, you know, this is what I'm trying to remember because I saw it after it moved
to the
Lincoln Center Theater. Yeah. And I may have seen Courtney B. Vance.
Yes. Okay. So James McDaniel was the original lead in this play. Peter, I believe, is the name of the character.
Paul.
And yep. Mary. It's all of them. So Paul, yes, James McDaniel, and he left the show to go be on NYPD Blue, which became a gigantic show.
Yep.
He was replaced by Courtney B. Vance, who you might know from Law & Order. He is also the husband of Angela Bassett.
And the character – well, we won't get into the character yet, but Stockard Channing
– yes.
In a rare turn – this doesn't happen very often.
Not anymore.
She created the part – on stage in New York, and they hired her to be in the movie too.
Yes.
And it's always such a wonderful gift when we get to see a great performance like that on film. There's a century-long history of stage actors being screwed by not being hired for the movie versions of the roles they created.
They created, yes.
But this is a nice exception to that. John Cunningham, who played her husband, did not get to make that transition. They hired Donald Sutherland.
Yes.
Of course, a wonderful actor and does a great job.
Speaking
of the
Hunger Games.
Indeed. So the play is about – and it's almost hard to believe that this is the subject of the play.
Yeah.
But it's about a well-to-do
– well-to-do is exactly what I was about to say.
– couple – who live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
They're art dealers.
They're wheeler dealers as well as art dealers.
And they're waspish.
Yes.
Incredibly so.
And a young black man shows up at their apartment one night with a knife wound, claiming that A, he was just attacked in Central Park, right across the street from their apartment.
And can I use your phone?
Can he use their phone? And of course, they're concerned. Oh, is he okay? What's going on? But also claims to be a friend of their son, who's at college.
Yes.
And, or is it their kids in general?
Yes. I think both of their kids.
Yeah. That's right. Two of their kids are at Harvard. That's right.
He knows their children and he knows their friends' children.
Yes. And so they're, you know, they take him in tentatively at first, and then he ingratiates himself into their lives.
Yes.
By saying that he is the son of Sidney Poitier.
The one and only Sidney Poitier.
That's, and again, we won't reveal much more, because if you haven't seen it, that's revealed to you pretty early on in the film.
In the film. But they're charmed by him.
Yes.
Welcome him into their life, and that's where the movie goes.
And so the story takes
watch
off.
It, yes.
You know, who do you think thought of Will Smith for this part? It's not that I found it such a stretch for him to have taken on, but it has as much to do with Fresh Prince as a bologna sandwich. I mean, it's you know, it's such a 180.
Yeah, and I couldn't really find any backstory to the casting process of this film, but he was a star. Mm-hmm. He was age appropriate. And they took a risk. I would assume what they thought was a risk. Like, well, is he going to have that Fresh Prince baggage?
Yeah.
But he didn't.
No, he sure didn't. And looking at it today, it's impressive.
It's very impressive. And again, the context of this is incredible, that he was on a TV show at the time. He does this blistering performance in an indie film, essentially, an indie film, an Oscar-nominated film.
Well, it was really a studio movie.
But very limited release.
Yeah.
Okay. But what were you going to say?
I was going to say that in those days, what we now think of indie films still got made by the studios sometimes.
Yes, that's true. That's
true. This was an MGM movie.
Yes. Okay. Different era. But he pulls off this performance of an incredibly complex person.
Yes.
Psychologically complex. He's believable in every situation in the movie.
Yes.
And he did this while he was currently hamming it up on television every week.
Yeah.
And then he just nails it in this movie that I had heard about when it was out, but I knew it wasn't funny. Mm-hmm. That's why I didn't go see it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like,
and probably why
Fresh
a lot
Prince.
Of people didn't go see it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's worth a look. First off, the material's really strong.
John Guare is one of the most important American playwrights.
And he did his own screenplay, another rarity.
Yes.
They hired the playwright to do the screenplay adaptation and another smart move. So he opens it up, to use that term that they always use for plays, and found some clever ways to take it out of a one-set stage piece that it essentially was. And it's pretty effective.
Yeah.
It's pretty effective. Nothing is like seeing a play live in the theater. And I say
of course.
This, of course, as a movie buff of the you know of the highest order. I mean, I love films, but I just love going to see great theater. There's something electric when you're in that theater, and you're involved, you're engaged in the performance. There's always that little bit of electricity, that tension going, because anything could happen.
And that's what's amazing.
Anything could happen.
That's what's amazing when you feel that in a performance on film.
Yes.
When you feel that in the film performance, it's like, well, this is something else.
Yeah. And I'll never forget my reaction to Stockard Channing in that performance. She was just fabulous. She's still a great actress.
Yes.
And has gotten a handful of great parts over the years. If you just know her as Rizzo from Grease,
yeah.
There's more. There's more to her.
I think
her
those
career.
Are her two most successful roles, though. Yeah. Like,
well, she was great on The West Wing also.
Right. Right.
In terms of popular, you know, material.
What's zeitgeisty about her, yeah.
But, gosh, she's good. And she got an Oscar nomination.
She did.
For this performance in Six Degrees of Separation, playing a woman who is made vulnerable.
Yeah, because
in surprising ways by the arrival of this young fellow.
Yeah, because at first it's told in this context where essentially, you know, because of the life that these people live, they're constantly going to parties and events, and all these people that are in their world want to hear this fantastic story about this fantastical thing that happened to them. And little by little, as they are repeating the story, they relive it.
Yeah.
We see them, you know, we see the story happen, but we see them also after the story reliving it and thinking about it in a new light. And it's pretty amazing. Great cast of supporting characters too. You got Ian McKellen in there.
Oh yes.
Bruce Davidson, Anthony Michael Hall, Heather Graham, Anthony Rapp for you Rent fans, but my favorite actor in this whole movie, J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams was one of the children
in this
movie. Yes, he was. J.J. Abrams was in this movie. And he actually made a TV show called 6 Degrees years later based on a theory from this movie.
Oh, my gosh. I did not know this.
Now you know it, Malton.
Oh, you've laid it on the line.
I can't believe I actually got to impress you with the little piece of information.
You absolutely have impressed me. I'll impress you by saying you left out one name, which is Mary Beth Hurt.
Yes, Mary Beth Hurt, also very great.
Who plays Bruce Davison's wife
yes.
in the film. And it's directed by a director I very much admire, an Aussie director named Fred Skepsy, who has done a lot of good work. He did The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith years ago, and Roxanne with
One
Steve
of my
Martin.
Favorites, Roxanne.
Yep, A Cry in the Dark with Meryl Streep, IQ, Empire Falls, a wonderful TV movie with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and a film that came out just the year before last. It was very sweet, called Words and Pictures, with Clive Owen and Juliette Binoche.
Oh, okay.
That's a nice movie too. But he had done one other play adaptation, which was David Hare's Plenty.
Yes, which was very popular as well.
Yes. So he had that experience under his belt of taking a stage piece and turning it into a real movie, and he does it again here.
Yeah. I'd assume that the collaboration between him and John Guare was quite fruitful.
I would think so, and I think the evidence is there in the finished product. But Will Smith, if you only know him from his years of movie stardom and the many vehicles he's appeared in and the great work he's done and the popular work he's done, it's well worth taking a look back at 6 Degrees of Separation.
And I'll say one thing, and I hope this doesn't ruin anything, but again, considering that theater to film adaptation, in the theater, you can have gigantic monologues because you're just there and a person's going to talk for a really long time. It's sometimes very hard to make that work on film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a gigantic monologue in this movie that Will Smith has to do. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was riveted. Every single moment, I'm like, he just made that work on film and they figured that out. And that was always incredible to me. So again, hats off to Will Smith on this performance.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. He earns all those accolades. All those accolades.
Yeah, about two or three accolades.
Now, can I do a little sidebar here, Baron?
Sidebar.
Okay, all right. In 1990, when the play was new and it was playing at Lincoln Center in New York, I was sent to New York. At the time, I was working for Entertainment Tonight, and every now and then, they'd send me to New York to do a press junket. And I would have either just a 24-hour or 48-hour turnaround. And if I was lucky, I'd get to see a friend for lunch or dinner and maybe take in a play or something like that. And I was walking across the street on Sheridan Square. I will never forget this. And I was on ET a lot at the time, and the show was very hot, very, very hot. So I was very visible.
Yeah, okay. People could recognize you.
Yeah. And this guy says, Leonard Maltin. I said, yeah. As we're crossing the street, he's going the other way. I said, yeah. He said, I'm the guy from 6 Degrees. I said, huh? He said, I'm the real guy.
Oh, wow.
It was based on a real person.
Yes, it
was. And it's like I hadn't seen the play yet. And I said, oh, well, hi. What do you say to that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, hi, and I hope you're still not, you know, having delusions.
So you had heard about him
a little bit. Or scamming people. I knew just a little, like the log line. That's all I knew.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. And then he kept on going. I mean, he kind of buttonholed me for a minute, got my attention, and then moved on. I later read that he tried to, I think the word would be, shake down John Guare for a piece of the action on the play.
Is he saying, you stole my life?
Yeah, something like that, which is kind of funny coming from him.
Wow, yeah. You can't con a con man.
But wow, I mean, that's one of those moments that, and I'd forgotten about it until watching the movie just now, revisiting the movie. Oh, wow.
That's great.
Now, if I had known more about him, would I have stopped and had a conversation? I don't know.
You probably would have run.
Yes, I might have. This is somebody I didn't want in my life. That's for sure. What would you have done?
Me, very different situation, Leonard. I mean, racially especially. Mm-hmm. But I would have, you know, there would have been some high-fiving, maybe a mm-hmm. little dancing. No, I'm joking. I'm just being an idiot. I have no idea. I would have been wary. You know what yeah, I mean? Yeah. I'm very hard to read. Don't be fooled by my positive voice. But I would have put on that mask, that social mask mm-hmm. maybe, and run really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Right. That's kind of amazing. So after that, how long was it until you hit sight?
I can't trace my movements, so I don't know. But when I saw the play and then realized what a unusual person, let's just say, this must have been, I was glad that I didn't have a longer conversation. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Listen, before we move on, I wanted to bring up something, and you tell me if you like this train of thought or not.
Okay.
But normally, on our previous editions of this podcast, we have selected a hit movie, a sleeper movie, and then a turkey. Well, since we're doing breakthroughs, we're not obviously talking about turkeys. We're bending our own rules a little today.
Yeah, because we can.
Because no one's stopping us. But I was thinking about breakthroughs that didn't quite happen.
Fall-throughs.
Yeah. break-offs.
Okay.
I don't know, break-ups.
All right.
Breakdowns.
Breakdown performances.
For instance, okay. I remember in the 80s. Yes, I remember the 80s. All right.
Wait, do you remember the 80s?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, cool.
Okay, I was there. Okay. I remember hearing some buzz about a young actor named Kevin Costner. And I kept hearing it. And films would come out and he'd be in them. And I was like, this guy's going to be a big star. And the film would come out, and he wasn't a big star. And then another one would come out, and he still wasn't a big star. When Silverado came out in 1985, Lawrence Kasdan's big all-star Western, he got more attention. He definitely got more attention. But it still wasn't quite, well, here he is, we've anointed a new star.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it was a slow burn.
It was a slow burn, and then came The Untouchables, which was a great part for him as Elliot Ness. Opposite, you know, Sean Connery and a terrific cast, Robert De Niro, all these great people in the film. But they seem to get the lion's share of attention, not
yes.
him.
Sean Connery got an Oscar nomination for that.
He did. By then, people now started to know who he was and recognize him. And then in a row, he made No Way Out, Bull Durham, and Field of Dreams.
Boom, boom, boom.
Okay, now you're a star.
Yeah.
Now that's a star. A star with enough clout to get to make Dances with Wolves just a few years later.
Yes.
And walk away with two Oscars for Best Picture and Best Director. But that promised breakthrough didn't happen the way it did for Jennifer Lawrence.
Right.
Let's say. Just as she's the epitome of a successful breakthrough.
Yes. Where it's like, boom, here you are.
Here you are, boom. And our last selection today will be that too. Another example of that is Colin Farrell.
Yes.
Some years later, I started hearing about him. I think when a little movie that Joel Schumacher made called Tigerland came out, a really good, tough movie about training American soldiers for combat overseas, but they do it in the Deep South. Mm. They try to replicate the terrain of I think it was Vietnam.
Right.
And
sort of the muddy, kind of swampy.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was very good in it, but it didn't make him a star. The film didn't really take off. Then I saw him in a film called Heart's War with Bruce Willis, a POW film, and a courtroom drama. Mm. I think he played American in that too, which he's done more than
many
once.
Many times, yeah.
And that film was kind of a flop, and it didn't make him a star. Then he's in a thriller, a silly thriller called Phone Booth.
Yes.
About a guy who picks up a phone on the streets of Manhattan, and there's a creep on the other end of the line who keeps him there, manages to stall him for 90 minutes while he hatches his nefarious
classic scheme. Suspense thriller plot at that time.
It didn't quite work either. So I don't know when it finally happened for Colin Farrell. Each film, of course, builds awareness and builds recognition, which I guess is the same as awareness. I guess it is the same as awareness. My goodness.
Recognition and
awareness.
Pardon my redundancy.
But he never had that one movie that really did it, pushed him over the top, said, oh, that's Colin Farrell. Yeah, he's a movie star.
He's arrived. Here's this guy.
Yeah. I mean, the next time I remember he really knocked me out was when he played Bullseye in Daredevil, because Bullseye is a character that's so out there.
Yeah.
And he seemed like he was really insane.
He was, and it's a much maligned movie for many different reasons, but it's a hell of a performance
yeah.
that he turns in, especially if you kind of only knew about the guy, and you're like, who is this guy
yes.
that has carved a bullseye into his forehead? Yes. Yikes.
To me, the point is that the movie business is, and always has been, and I think always will be, a crapshoot.
Yes.
It's not a science. You can't plan some things, even though a lot of big studios – and powerful producers and executives and directors think they can do that and try to, but it doesn't always work.
And sometimes it works against you.
It can. Well, an example of that, I remember in the late 90s, Vanity Fair put Gretchen Mol on the cover and sort of announced her as the next big thing. I don't remember what the headline, what the copy was on the cover, but they proclaimed that this, you know,
young Hollywood's
young,
here.
Young, attractive yeah. blonde actress was going to be the next big thing. And that was a tie-in, I believe, with the release of Rounders, the film she made with Matt Damon and Edward Norton.
Right.
Which was a good movie. And I think a somewhat successful movie. But it did not springboard her into a starring career.
Right.
And I read interviews with her subsequent to that saying that that article kind of became a curse for her in a way. Because as much as you desire that kind of publicity when you're – especially when you're just starting out, it created unrealistic expectations. And when she didn't seem to live up to them in most people's view, they kind of wrote her off or said, oh, she flopped. She's a failure, which she wasn't. But she just didn't get that breakthrough to stardom
so
as
the
they
hype
predicted.
Kinda, the hype kind of undermined her.
And which is a bummer for her, of course, and further proof that you can't manage some things. They just have to happen.
Yeah, yeah. But you have to be consistent. You have to be good.
Well, yes. Well, she is good.
She is consistent.
You know what film I love her in? I love her in The Notorious Betty Page, where she plays the great pinup queen of the 50s, Betty Page.
A movie I haven't seen, but now I will.
Oh, it's really good, and she's really good in it. She not only – well, she looks right for the part. I mean, she's an attractive woman with a great body, and that's step one.
It's important if you're playing Betty Page, yeah.
But she's really you really believe her. She captures, I think, that woman, that persona. And, of course, she's had a great run now on Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
Recurring role, you know, for –
which has come to an end.
Many seasons, exactly. Yeah. So I think by now she can say she's, you know, she's put in her time and had a decent career. But that must have been really tough when everyone around you is saying, you're the next big thing.
Yes.
And you don't become the next big thing.
Frustrating. I assume a lot of walls got punched.
Yes, I would think so. And rightly so.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, I think, an emblematic example of a true breakthrough performance. One film that made a star, absolutely made an overnight star. What is it? You'll just have to wait a moment to find out.
Attention all Earwolf and Wolf Pop shoppers. New merchandise has arrived in the online store. Head over to store.earwolf.com to pick up new soft tri-blend American-made t-shirts from How Did This Get Made, Comedy Bang Bang, Never Not Funny, Scarborough Country, and best of all, the first Wolf Pop t-shirt ever. Plus, Earwolf, which is our sister McNetwork, is celebrating the season with an ugly holiday shirt. It's got ugly little reindeer, ugly little snowflakes, comes in two colors, and is made of 100% fine, ring-spun, combed cotton.
I know what I'm going to get you for Christmas.
I don't know. It was in bold. What, it was in bold? No need. Head over to store.earwolf.com today to admire the selection. That's store.earwolf.com. Thanks for listening.
We're back. The we being Leonard Maltin here and
Baron Vaughn. And this is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes trite is right, as Robert Benchley once said.
Oh, I've never heard that, but yeah. In this case it is. If I'm the one being trite, I'm totally right.
All right. Our last selection is.
But not leastly.
That's right. Far from least. Is somebody who is back in the spotlight, having been out of it for too long.
So there's a movie out called Birdman, and this man is the Birdman.
That's right, Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, who is such an enormous talent.
Yes.
And who can do so much and has done so much, but hasn't had really many opportunities in recent films. He's been in two movies in the past year, but undistinguished roles and undistinguished movies, RoboCop and Need for Speed.
Yes.
But here in Birdman, he gets a showcase that is just astonishing. And everyone is saying he's going to get an Oscar nomination. I agree with that. I think he will because it is an extraordinary showcase and an extraordinary performance. I don't love the movie, but I love him in it.
I love all the performances, definitely.
Yes, the performance level is very, very high.
Because, you know, again, talking about theater, this is a movie, Birdman is a movie about people who are trying to do a play.
Yeah.
And these are incredibly theatrical, dramatic people.
Yep.
And the people who play all of these people just bring heat because they have to.
All right. Now, let me spin back the dial.
The time clock.
Thank you. I was hoping you would do something of that sort. We're spinning back to 1982 because I remember very specifically and clearly my wife and I going to see this movie, Night Shift, in our neighborhood on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where a lot of it was shot. That was part of why I remember is that, hey, they just did that around the corner. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Very meta.
And I remember Michael Keaton's entrance. I just revisited it.
Yes.
It's 14 minutes into the movie.
Yes, which is amazing by today's standards.
But it's an entrance with a capital E because Henry Winkler is the established star in the movie.
Yes.
And Michael Keaton gets second billing, but co-star billing above the title.
His first lead in a
That's
film.
That's right. So I didn't know him. I had not seen Working Stiffs, the sitcom he did with Jim Belushi. I guess I had seen him on that Mary Tyler Moore variety show because David Letterman was on that show
right.
too.
That was all he had done up until that point.
Right.
He was a known stand-up.
But I didn't really know him. I wasn't that familiar with him. He gets an entrance here where he is seen first in silhouette through a pebbled glass, you know, door, and then bursts in, you know, know, he's humming, singing, and all that. And it is the entrance of a star. That's how I saw it then, and that's how I see it now.
Yeah.
Because it's a wonderfully funny performance.
Right.
And a wonderfully funny character. Bill Blazjowski. Blazjowski? Did I say it right? Bill Blazjowski.
Don't remember.
Call me Billy Blaze.
Yeah, he calls.
Call me Billy Blaze.
Because you can't pronounce it.
He also says, I'm an idea man.
Yeah. I'm an idea man. It's pretty amazing because it's almost like a TV show.
Yeah.
This movie, the way that they introduce the characters is like a pilot. You meet Henry Winkler, who's this kind of a morbid guy going through his day in New York. He is the manager of a morgue, a city morgue, daytime shift. But then someone decides that he's going to get moved to the night shift. Then he's got to train this new guy.
Yeah.
And that's when this man, Michael Keaton, walks into the room 15 minutes into the movie.
Yes. And all Winkler's character wants out of this demotion to night shift is peace and quiet. He's a nebbishy character who cannot stand conflict, who lets people walk all over him. And so if he's got to put up with this terrible night shift, which puts him at odds with his fiance.
Yes.
Then at least he wants peace and quiet. And he's not going to have it anymore because here comes Billy Blaze.
Yes.
Who's going to disrupt everything about his routine.
He's loud in the way that he dresses. He's loud in the way that he talks. His music is loud. His ideas are loud. His presence is just loud.
Funny, funny character. Funny performance. Funny character written by the very prolific Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel.
Yeah.
Who ended up having a long and fruitful association with Ron Howard, who directed this movie. And they'd already worked together because they wrote episodes of Happy Days. They worked with Gary Marshall on The Odd Couple. I think Lowell Ganz is credited with actually creating Laverne and Shirley and even Joni Loves Chachi.
Which are spinoffs of Happy Days.
Right. He may have had a partner in that too.
And that's an important piece of information. Happy Days was on the air when this movie came out.
Yeah.
Ron Howard, this was his directorial debut.
No. It's not his direct. It's his
feature.
No. It's his
major
studio.
Major feature motion. Debut.
His first directing job was for Roger Corman.
Right. He had done a couple. I mean,
Grand Theft Auto. Well, okay. That was a theatrical movie.
All right.
Most of those
all right.
May have, hey, most of those theaters may have been drive-ins.
I retract my statement.
But they were theaters nonetheless.
Studio picture? Okay. What's the definition?
Picture.
Okay.
Yep.
First studio feature.
Yes. First studio feature that cost more than $1.49.
Exactly. Produced by Brian Grazer.
Right.
And this is his first collaboration with Brian Grazer.
And now I just happened to – pardon my name drop – I just happened to interview Ron Howard last month on stage at a speaker's series at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we spent a lovely evening together on stage with a very attentive audience. We were in Andy Griffith country. We were in North Carolina. They were real happy to see Ron Howard.
Oh, I bet.
They were real happy.
Were they whistling when he came out on stage?
No, they resisted that, but just barely. Wonderful, receptive audience. And Ron is a great guy, very good and good-hearted and decent fellow. And normally, I think he might have resisted talking so much about the Andy Griffith Show, but he knew
Andy.
He knew that those people really wanted to hear. And he loved Andy, and he loved Don Knotts, and he loved his experience on the show. So it was no problem.
No Happy Days questions?
We ran out of time for Happy Days questions.
Okay.
But I did ask him about Night Shift.
Oh, good.
Because it was his first
studio feature.
Yeah, sort of his breakthrough movie as a director,
yes.
Really. And this is what he told me, that they had the script. They were looking for a star. And he said, everybody they offered to turned it down. They offered it to Chevy Chase. He turned it down. They offered it to John Belushi.
Yeah.
He turned it down. They offered it to everybody. Bill Murray turned it down.
Huh.
He remembers all of those people who were then considered, you know, bankable box office comedy stars turned it down. He finally got his pal and co-star Henry Winkler to sign on. And when he sent Henry the script, he said, which part do you want to play? And Winkler, being the smart guy he is, said, I should play the straight man.
Yeah,
because people have seen me do the funny stuff.
They've seen him do the funs, yeah.
And they're going to expect that. I want to give him something different.
And so, that's what he does in this movie. He's trying so hard not to be the fons, it feels like.
Right. And so he does play essentially the straight man character.
Yes.
And then they saw Michael Keaton's work and they hired him. And the studio was a little wary. They weren't 100% behind it, but they said, okay, because everyone else on board, I guess, was so enthusiastic about him. And Ron said early on they cut together some footage, showed it to the executives, and they said, okay, yeah, you're on the right track here. And they sure were. They sure were.
It is a – and, you know, you had said that to me, that he bursts onto the screen, and he totally does. And you watch this movie, and he's clearly the standout performance in this movie. I'll admit I'm a fan of Shelley Long.
But and she's good in this movie.
She's okay. I felt like she was a little miscast, but, you know, again, this is a movie that's very steeped in the 80s, like we were talking about.
Oh, yes.
So it's like – Shelley Long plays a woman of the night. I'll say that. I don't want to tell you too much because it'll ruin the movie. But I had trouble believing Shelley Long as that. Surprise, surprise.
All right. Well, let's say it's an idealized Hollywood.
It's an idealized version. Where Shelley Long is who you might meet in Times Square, New York in 1982. But Michael Keaton, he has all these really interesting instincts.
Mm-hmm.
He is so connected with Henry Winkler. He can do all this flights of fancy in one moment and then be very quiet and very focused in the next. And it's a performance where you're like, oh, this guy can do a lot of different things. I wonder what else he can do.
Because that character could have been just obnoxious.
Yes.
He could have driven us crazy, and that would have been a bad misstep and an easy one to make.
Very easy,
an
yes.
An easy one to
especially
make.
Especially for like a broad comedy.
Right. But he's not obnoxious. He's just a character. He's a colorful character who's a little clueless about himself and really wants to be liked very much, especially by his working partner, Henry Winkler.
Yeah,
And it's the evolution of their relationship and friendship is a big part of what the movie is about.
Definitely.
And as I say, it made him a star. This is the absolute definition of a breakthrough.
Yeah.
Because the next year, he was suddenly Michael Keaton in Mr. Mom.
Mr. Mom.
Johnny Dangerously, Gung Ho, which reunited him with Ron Howard.
Yes.
And then we went on to Beetlejuice. And then he started feeling it was time to flex some different muscles, and he did Clean and Sober, which is actually a really fine performance.
Oh, okay.
In a dramatic film about an alcoholic.
Oh, I haven't seen that movie.
A recovering alcoholic. And then, of course, he was cast as Batman.
Which people were mad about.
Now, and this is before the internet.
Yes.
I don't remember – I remember the hue and cry. I remember the furor that fans generated when they heard this outrageous news that Michael Keaton, that funny guy, was cast –
Mr. Mom?
As Batman. I don't remember how they expressed it. I guess they wrote letters and made phone calls.
Yeah, that's the original YouTube comments are letters to the editor. That's when you had right. to open up the paper and be like, oh, I disagree with what you wrote last right. week.
But man, they were upset. And then, of course, he delivered.
He delivered. And to my generation, we know him as Batman because that Tim Burton Batman, which was 89, only 7 years mm-hmm. after Night Shift came out, we remember him as Batman, unless you, of course, saw the Adam West cartoon. Yeah. I mean, not cartoon, just TV show.
Well, it was a live action cartoonish
TV show. Yes, yes. Right. But, you know, Michael Keaton defined what Batman was for a little bit, and Tim Burton's Batman did as well. But I think in the tradition of Batman, whoever plays Batman is always going to get yelled at about it. It has happened in every single instance.
I guess so. You know, looking back, much as I love Night Shift, and I do still, I think my favorite Michael Keaton performance is still Beetlejuice.
Oh, okay.
It is. He is so over the top is the wrong.
Just real quick, how many times have we said that word? Only twice, right?
What?
The title of that movie. I don't want to say it a third time if you know what I'm talking about. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? And scene. What were you saying, Leonard? What were you saying, Leonard?
You got me.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
You got me.
I saw.
You got me again. Man. I am off my game here.
But you're saying that's one of your favorite performances.
Yes, in that film.
Yeah.
It's like not mentioning the Shakespeare play, the Scottish play.
The Scottish play.
Well, I'll tell you, it is a great performance. It is one of the most ferociously funny comedic performances ever put on film.
And you also feel the fear. You also feel the con man of that character, and you feel that he's trying to get these people to sign on the dotted line so he can do something. You've seen Beetlejuice. You better have seen Beetlejuice, listeners. Please see Beetlejuice.
I'll tell you. And you know –
Just said it three times, son of a bitch.
There were moments in Birdman when I thought about him as Beetlejuice.
Ah.
I really did. It's – I don't know if they were conscious or not. Or it's just that me imposing my will on the situation. But he has that same kind of manic energy at times in Birdman. The Birdman character goes all over the place as the film goes all over the place. But there were times when I thought, oh, gosh, this is kind of an echo of Beetlejuice.
Mm.
Maybe people will disagree with that, and they're free to disagree.
But that's also you're comparing it to your favorite Michael Keaton performance.
Yes, I guess I am.
So that's also a compliment when you think that.
Well, anyway, I hope that Birdman represents a renaissance for Michael Keaton and that people will pay more attention to him. He's such a great talent.
Here's my favorite Michael Keaton performance, Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, yes, for Kenneth Branagh.
Dogberry. Mm-hmm. He plays. Very surprising. You're like, wait a minute, that's Michael Keaton doing Shakespeare, and you don't even think about it. He's fantastic at that.
Well, he's in a small movie I like called Game 6.
Mm, don't know it.
From 2005. And he directed himself in a movie that's actually kind of interesting called The Merry Gentleman in 2008. These are little sleeper-esque titles I drop in there just
Thank you.
For good measure.
Yeah, I didn't know about those, and I don't think our listeners did either, so I'm going to go watch them.
Well, I think we've tackled three interesting, worthy performances and three interesting, worthy films today.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen any or all of them, we heartily recommend you do. Because, again, I'll wager a lot of people who are flocking to Hunger Games have never seen Widder's Bone.
Yeah.
And
hopefully they can take it.
tough movie, no question of that. Tough movie.
You think The Hunger Games is rough? Yikes.
Oh, boy. 6 Degrees of Separation with Will Smith. And finally, Michael Keaton in his breakthrough movie, Night Shift. And we're going to break it off now that we've broken through.
Yes. This might be our breakthrough podcast.
It could happen.
Yeah.
this could be the one.
Maybe not, because I said broadcast before I said podcast. Breakthrough podcast.
Well, we're prodding people to listen to our podcast.
We're prodding. Okay, good one. Good one.
You know, we have to amuse each other because there's no one else here in the studio except our masterful engineer who has been trained not to laugh out loud.
Yeah, he's trying.
You could see him stifling the laughter, stuffing a handkerchief in his mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, because otherwise it would just ruin the track.
He's also taking pictures in the background.
So he's playing Tetris. He's doing a lot of things in the background.
Oh, all sorts of things. I bet he's got Minesweeper on there.
But listen, folks, we're happy to have this chance to talk to you, as we always are. You can always find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin, and on my website, which is leonardmaltin.com, where I review new movies and talk about other interesting stuff, leonardmaltin.com.
Yes, and you can find me on a couple different websites: Google, Bing, Lycos, AltaVista, and of course, netscape.com. Just type my name into the search engine, which is Baron Vaughn, and see what comes up.
What does come up?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
Maybe my website, baronvaughn.com, or my Twitter.
All right. We'll have to find out. There's your challenge, listeners. We will see you next time. Take care.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.